As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to the Metrospective podcast from The Athletic. Spring is in the air. Spring training is fully afoot. I'm Ted Berg and I am joined on the line by The Athletic's Mets beat writer, Tim Britton. Tim, we have the same initials. Do you also own a bunch of Tampa Bay Rays stuff?
You know, I did point out at one point last year, I think it was Dave Lennon from Newsday. I'm going to call Dave Lennon from Newsday out, talking about how much he liked the Rays uniforms. And I thought, as someone who is very invested in how the letters T and B look on a hat, that the Rays could do better. And they, in fact, have done better in their past.
See, I have a lot to say about that topic, but we'll get to uniforms a little bit in a while. I want to get to the news of the day first. And that is that Pete Alonso, the Mets first baseman, 2019 Rookie of the Year, I think, a franchise cornerstone to be unceremoniously departed from social media. What happened?
Well, I think you used passive voice there. I don't think he was dumped by social media.
No, I said he departed. He departed.
Okay.
He departed
Sorry. From. Yeah, but I think that was his active choice, unlike some others in the news in 2021. Yeah.
Pete Alonso has been kicked off at Twitter for spreading misinformation. about whether or not the Mets should go.
We have not talked to Pete yet, so we don't know exactly why. I can imagine it being just a basic desire to focus on the field, as players often, a lot of players, even if they are still on social media or still have active accounts, don't really pay attention to them during the season quite the same way, because why would you? It's not going to be more praise than criticism. Even if you are a player who's had the successful track record that Pete Alonso has had, there's still 29 other teams that dislike you, and some significant portion of the fan of every fan base hates every player on that team to some extent. There's always someone who's a Mets fan who dislikes someone on the Mets.
It's funny you mentioned that, because while looking for this Pete Alonso news, or for more on it on Twitter, I discovered that there is apparently, and I don't want to give too much time to this because there's always just going to be this fringe element with every player who doesn't like that guy. But I was a little bit surprised to see that there are some at least fairly credible voices expressing some backlash to Pete Alonso, some because he's too vulgar on Twitter, which, like, come on. But then also people saying he's not that good and he's a bench player and pointing to his 2020 season, which was disappointing, as evidence that, he's not the player he was the year before. And again, it seems so silly to me because everybody knows it's 57 games that he played, and that it can't mean that much.
And he was still 20% better than the league average when it comes to OPS with his OPS plus there. I think it's kind of the inevitable backlash to anything or anyone being popular. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Alonso's context, you have another player who predominantly plays his position on the team who is very good in Dominic Smith. So mm-hmm. I think there is an element of the fan base that wants to have a Smith versus Alonso debate, especially at a time when there is no designated hitter. The good news is the Mets as a front office, as an organization, do not have to have that debate. This isn't like Ryan Howard coming up when the Phillies had Jim Thome and you've got to choose between the two on a daily basis and you've got to trade one long term. The Mets can probably get by with Smith playing in left field in 2021. And then I think the expectation from most everyone in baseball is that we have a designated hitter next year and that you can go back to playing them both the same time with Smith playing first most of the time, Alonso playing at the other time, and have a better defensive outfield in that case. So I think, you know, it's basically whenever someone comes on the scene as popular and a bit brash as Alonso could be at times, though, you know, not
extremely
Bernie Van Wagenen
fun.
And come get us brash.
Yeah. Brash in an extremely fun team friendly way. Like I would have, it's hard to imagine having really like too much. I don't know. I'm just past like fighting about that stuff, but it's just like, this guy's having fun playing baseball. Like, who cares? Just enjoy it.
Right. And there's so few ways, you know, we talk all the time about how sports can, as you get older and more knowledgeable about them, sometimes lose some of the fun aspects of them. And Pete Alonso is very fun, like in a lot of different ways, as a player and as a personality. And you would hope that he would have 100% approval rating by the Mets fan base. But, you know, I don't know that, you know, I'm sure in 1969 Twitter, there was someone who didn't like the way Tom Seaver finished the season. You know, Seaver blew it in game one of the division series of the LCS. You know, we can't trust him in big spots or something like that.
I'm trying to think of like what player in Mets history might have 100% approval of Mets Twitter. And it's either like Joe McEwing or it's someone that's like where it's like Nolan Ryan as a Met. Cause you know, like everyone on like 1980 Mets Twitter was all claiming they knew Nolan Ryan would be this good and the Mets should have never traded him away.
It's not Jordani Valdespin. He seems like he should have 100% approval rating.
He has 100% approval rating from me, but me alone, it seems like, at least based on some conversations I've had with people in the organization. He's not playing for the Mets anymore. Someone who is now playing for the Mets and the subject of really an excellent profile, Tim, that I really enjoyed reading from you at The Athletic. Tell me what you've learned. And now he's arrived at camp, so now we've heard from a little bit. What do we know about Francisco Lindor that we didn't know last week?
His hair is blue. That is the most important thing. And apparently, you know, he gets a little tired of the regular color, so he decided to go with blue because said as it would fade, it would go to like a cool silverish gray kind of thing over time.
But
it looks
cool.
Good. Looks good now with the, especially with the blue spring training jerseys that the guys wear. You know, I talked to some people who knew Lindor back kind of before he was, you know, an all-star shortstop in the major leagues. His high school coach, who's actually grew up a Mets fan on Long Island, the guys from the Cleveland organization who scouted him and signed him. And, you know, when you talk to those people, you get a sense like the first time you see Francisco Lindor play, you remember that day. You know, his high school coach, Tim Layden, said, you know, he was new as a high school coach that year in Lindor's senior year, and he knew that there was a guy on the team that was supposed to be like a first round major league draft pick. And the first time he saw Lindor, he goes, "Oh yeah, that's totally legit, 100%. I understand." Yeah. And he's like, "It took, you know, 5 minutes. It was like three ground balls hit to him, and you knew that he had the goods." And for some of the scouts, it was, you know, you're there to watch someone else, and then you just see this kid playing shortstop as a sophomore. It was. For Lindor is like a 15-year-old, and he really stood out. I thought one of the interesting things was just the way they talked up his maturity. Like he was a younger high school senior than mm-hmm. most people. He was 17 as a high school senior. That was younger than I was. And you know, you think of the Mets with Brett Beatty was a 19-year-old high school senior, their first round pick a couple of years ago. So to handle the amount of pressure he had on him, like, you know, every game you play, there's 100 scouts in attendance. There's guys watching your batting practice. There's guys showing up to your practices. Every move you make is chronicled. Like, you know, when someone asked Jed Hoyer, the Cubs GM, about vetting executives in the wake of things that happened with the Mets earlier this offseason, he said we should vet them like we vet first round picks, which tells you how closely they look at first round picks, closer than they do at managers or general managers that they're going to hire. That's how close the scrutiny is, and that Lindor was still every day there with a smile, never seemed like he had a bad day the entire time, and you know, was a guy who was just kind of an understood leader on his roster in high school. You know, a guy who showed up every day in practice, did the same thing, was the hardest worker on the team, even though he was already the best player. And just the way that sets a tone, and some Mets have already talked about, Michael Conforto talking on Tuesday afternoon, said you get the sense of the way he is a quiet leader right away in just, you know, the day and a half he's been in camp so far.
I love, and I want to get back to Lindor, but I love athlete origin stories so much. I don't know if you've had the opportunity ever to like see a future pro athlete that sort of everybody knows is a future pro athlete play in like high school, or I had an experience in Pee Wee football against a kid who wound up on an NFL taxi squad, and like I knew it in Pee Wee football. I was like, that guy's going to the NFL. That guy's way too good. And it's funny because it like sort of immediately crushes your own dreams when you're in fifth grade. It's like, I'm not going to play in the NFL. That guy's going to play in the NFL. But one of the best I ever heard was from Mike Trout's baseball, high school baseball coach, who said that Trout had been committed to, I think he was committed to East Carolina. And the East Carolina coach came to visit him and came to watch a game. And Trout's high school coach, so Trout in the game, I guess the hit a long fly ball, the center fielder misplayed it, and Trout ran it out for an inside the park home run. And Trout's high school coach turns around and sees the East Carolina coach leaving. And he's like, where are you going? And he's like, this kid's not coming to me. That's the best baseball player I've ever seen in my life. And sure enough, you know, Trout was then a first round draft pick, and within, by the time I think he would have been a sophomore at ECU, the best player in baseball. But Lindor, an interesting little foreshadowing in your article is that Lindor expressed, or his coach expressed, that he didn't need coaching for knowing where to stand in the infield. And when Lindor arrived at Mets camp and had a sort of long and interesting and possibly more nuanced than we're used to conversation about analytics in baseball, he expressed basically the same thing in terms of infield shifting.
Yeah, you know, it's, you can understand kind of the way he feels about it, because he's a guy who's always known where to play, like where to put himself, position himself defensively. His high school coach said, you know, it's like the first time we're playing every team. He's, you know, this, by the time the guy's up a second time, he knew where to stand, and where to position everyone else on the field around him. And Lindor basically said, you know, if a ball's gonna get by me and I'm not, and I've decided where to play, that's fine with me. I'll roll with that. But if I'm in a shift and I don't get to a ball because I was in the shift, that eats me up inside. And you can understand a player who is so used to relying on his instincts feeling that way. And I think a lot of players feel that way, you know,
you hear that from pitchers a lot too, especially like if there is a ground ball to a place where the second baseman might traditionally be standing or the third baseman might traditionally be standing and he's not there because it's shifted, it feels like you hear the complaints more often than you hear the like, oh phew, that obvious line drive single up the middle turned into a double play because we were shifted.
Yeah, you don't credit the shift as much as you detract from it when it hurts you as a defense, when, you know, you give up that weak ground ball gets through the left side because your shortstop is behind the second base bag. I think, you know, Lindor is not the only player to take a shot at analytics. You know, Michael Conforto today or Tuesday was talking about the way they've come to dominate the game a little bit. And I heard Garrett Cole talked about some things over at Yankees camp. And I think you've got players who are they're upset about the way the sport is being run in general, and then you know, they don't like the way analytics are being used. I think predominantly probably and how they're being used to decide who gets what, who gets paid what in free agency, and how good players are not getting paid what they think they're worth. And not a lot of teams are going after good players because they don't feel like even a good addition is worthwhile with where they are on the competitive win curve, basically. And then that trickles down to how they feel about that application within games, you know, with the classic example of Blake Snell being taken out in the World Series last year. You know, players, you grow up playing the game a certain way, and you understand the reasoning behind a lot of the things going into it. You know, Lindor knows about the percentages of where guys hit the ball, but he's also really confident in his own reads of how a player's swing works with a certain pitcher. And he thinks his judgments on kind of a granular instinctual level, how this guy performs against this specific kind of pitcher, will be better than the broader view of analytics. And you understand a player wanting to keep his own approach that way.
Yeah, and there's so much in there. And I suspect, at least, because Lindor and Cole are both union representatives, that it is there is some sort of gamesmanship maybe going on in advance of the presumably contentious collective bargaining that we know is to come, because it sounds like there's going to be some, and there should be some discussion about the game itself and its marketability and its popularity with the youth of America. And yes, like speeding the game along and having more action are clearly things they need. And I don't know, I hope this isn't the case, but I almost feel like I wonder if players are sort of trying to set this, to plant the seed that, you know, it's the infield shift that's slowing things down more than, to me, what seems obvious, which is the need for a pitch clock. Because I think if you actually dive into it, you know, it's not pitching changes and it's not mound visits and it's not infield shifts. It's just in this, and I believe Craig Counsell used the term a few years ago, and I've thought about it ever since, he called it the execution of pitches era. And I think what he's sort of referring to is the notion that starting pitchers nowadays, it's almost like you're running, you know, 90 to 100 wind sprints instead of a marathon. And, you know, and so each pitch comes with, you know, 25 seconds of quiet contemplation beforehand. And to me, that is like so obviously what's causing the game to take so long and so easily remedied by just putting in a pitch clock. And I understand why players don't want that, but I almost worry that that's what all this like sudden talk about too many analytics in the game is just sort of like this, okay, this is something we're going to fight for so we don't have to concede to a pitch clock.
Yeah, I think it's probably less with an on-field goal in mind as much as it is just to get teams to value players differently. Like Conforto was saying, you know, the primary issue he feels, and he's been the Mets union rep for a while, Cole and Lindor are guys on like the executive subcommittee for the Players Association. So all these guys have vested interests and kind of know what's going on with the union. Conforto said the primary issue is like teams being competitive. We want 30 teams trying to win. And it's really, you know, you look at the competitive landscape of the sport, and that's very clearly not the case. And it's not the case in a much more explicit fashion than it used to be. You know, when we were growing up, like there were years you knew going in the Mets were not going to make the playoffs. They were not as good as like the 1995 or 96 or whatever year you want to say in that era, Atlanta Braves. Like they were not going to win the division, but you never got the sense that they were explicitly trying not to win the division and trying to win as few games as possible. You've had really in the last decade that change with how teams approach things, and teams deciding that it doesn't really, they don't need to try very hard to win. You know, this goes back to everyone's villain for the last couple days, the resigned Mariners president Kevin Mather, talking about, you know, not wanting to play, not going to bring up Jared Kelenic at all in 2020, regardless of what happened with that team. And Seattle missed the playoffs by two games, and they played some pretty terrible corner outfielders. And there wasn't an ounce of introspection about the idea that Jared Kelenic might have helped them end the longest postseason drought in the sport, in North American sports, I believe, at this point, if they had decided to swallow the financial implications and play their best prospect a little bit in 2020. So,
and what is the guy for if not winning you a champ? Right? It's so. I mean, in that case, it seems so like self-defeating. You know, like what you're trying. Your point is to win, and this guy's going to help you win. Like, yeah, start the clock. Let's start the clock. Whatever.
Yeah, like I think it was Patrick Dubuque at Baseball Prospectus. I've read a couple different stories about this, so I hope I've got it right. Who pointed out that like Kelenic is more valuable to the Mariners right now as a prospect, as an idea, because of how he can be sold to the fan base, than he might be 3 years from now as a superstar player. That you have to pay a little bit more, you know, that being able to pitch him as the future means more to a team that is not really trying its hardest to win at the moment than it might be when he's your present. And that's a bad place for an organization to be in and for a sport to be in when several organizations are doing that.
Yeah. And I mean, we could talk for hours, I'm sure, about the issues to come in the new collective bargaining agreement and the various way it seems like, you know, teams are sort of squeezing out player salaries and plenty of teams seem to be disproportionately benefiting from revenue sharing, the way the competitive balance tax, the luxury tax, which was intended for that to create an atmosphere where 30 teams can compete, has instead become like quite the opposite, and a soft salary cap, which is costing the players as well. I think the last few CBAs have not worked out in the long run for the players, and for their sake, hopefully that turns around. But that's a subject for much later.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
In the news, on The Athletic. And a big one, and one I teased earlier. And I don't believe we brought up that Steve Cohen has returned to Twitter, but he was a big force, the driving force, certainly, behind this story. Rustin Dodd wrote about the Mets black jerseys of the late 1990s and the possibility that they're coming back. Where are you on this?
I'm on the record as not liking them aesthetically overall. As I think the discerning Mets fan points out in most of these instances, the black jerseys themselves are okay. It's the way they ruined every other Mets jersey, like that they no longer wore the blue hats very often. Mm-hmm. There was black drop shadow on everything. You know, that the Mets jerseys were not as good as they could be or as good as they currently are now because of the blacks' intrusion into every aspect of their identity. The black jerseys themselves, I'd be fine with returning on a limited basis. You know, you see some teams do Friday night home games in a certain alternate, or Saturday night games in an alternate. Like, I'd be okay with that. I would probably want them to not do it every time on a Friday night. That 13 times is too many for the black jerseys. You know, if you want to wear it on a series here or there against, you know, I thought going into the 2020 season, which was the 20th anniversary of the 2000 team, I thought it would make sense to maybe wear the black jerseys against like the Giants or the Cardinals, you know, the teams you beat in that postseason, something like that. I don't want to see them back where they're wearing a black jersey at home or on the road like 70 times a season the way it was for a little while there.
You just reminded me that the I was at a playoff game that year against the Giants, and I sat, my uncle had these unbelievable seats at Shea Stadium. And I scored my uncle's seat somehow, and they were right next to the comp seats for the San Francisco Giants. And so it was all the San Francisco Giants wives were and I possibly, well, you know, whatever. They were all sitting right next to us. And I just remember that they kept singing "Who Let the Dogs Out?" which is just like the most 2000 thing, right? Like that, just that is the weird time capsule moment in my head, is that they would be like, that one of them would stand up. I think that must have been like, maybe they didn't realize that every stadium in the country was playing that song, and they thought, oh, this is something we do in San Francisco. Like, this is a rallying cry for our team, because like one would stand up and yell "Who let the dogs out?" And then everyone else, like all of the Giants cheering section that was right, that was sort of buried there, would all do the oof, 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 oof. It was very silly. I have no point to make on that. I just
was that the Agbayani game or the Bobby Jones game? Because both are very memorable.
It was not the Bobby Jones game. I assume I don't actually remember the game. I only remember the you know, I was at a handful of playoff games in those years. And one other in those seats, and the other one I sat in those seats was the Robin Ventura Grand Slam single. So that is the far more memorable Shea Stadium playoffs turn of the millennium baseball memory for me, especially because I had class the next day in DC, and I was supposed to, it was like an afternoon game, and I was hoping
Sunday,
to catch
yeah.
I was hoping to catch the last Delta shuttle. It used to be, again, this is pre 9/11, so you could just like go to the airport and get on a plane, and so I was hoping to catch the last shuttle to DC, and I remember like desperately convincing my parents that I could go the next morning because I needed to stay for the game, and that obviously turned out to be a fine decision on my part. I think that I'm fine with the black jerseys. I think that what I'm about to say is going to lose me a ton of cred with Mets fans, and I'm good with it. I am so against the hegemony of blue in major league uniforms that if the Mets came out tomorrow and were like, yeah, we're, you know what, like, never mind blue and orange, we're going maroon and silver tomorrow, I would be like the one Mets fan who was psyched about it. And I would go out and buy the new stuff. Just, and it's not, and like, obviously, like, as you have, and as I have from growing up a Mets fan, there's like all these personal and emotional ties to the logo and the uniform and all these things. And I would like so happily throw all of that out just to have one baseball team wear a better color scheme, a more interesting one than just blue and orange or blue and red, which is every team. I think the reason the Padres got good in 2020 was not Fernando Tatis Jr. I think it was that they went back to the brown uniforms. And so, you know, like, I'm fine, but whatever, the black, whatever. I would be good with an overhaul. Like, you know, I prefer the traditional blue and orange. I think probably it's a little bit like Saturday Night Live, where like the one that's the best is always the one that was there when you were 13. And so like, yeah, like the best uniforms to me are the ones from the early 90s, like pre the white era, before, because remember the black replaced, they spent 1 year wearing the white hats on Sundays.
White, yeah.
And those were ridiculous looking. And so
I loved them at the time, though. I loved them at the time. I hate them in retrospect. Loved them at the time.
The trend I loved at the time, which the Mets did not get into, was that for a little while, a handful of teams started wearing road gray caps. And like the Royals and the Pirates, I believe, both went to road grays. And I remember really loving those. I think I actually had both a gray Royals and a gray Pirates hat when I was like in middle school. I would be cool with that. Like, I would be the Mets bringing in like a gray hat with the Mets logo, like a gray. I would like to see gray as a primary color for some team. I think that would be bold, you know, like make it your hat, a gray hat with a white logo. I don't know. I got ideas. If anyone has, I have no design skills, but if anyone wants to call me up, I can talk to you about color schemes I think would be cool in Major League Baseball. We have a question from a reader, and I want to end with that. But I didn't queue it up in my email before I teased it to you, and so now I have to do that, and this is the sound of me stalling. Here we go. It comes from Aaron Pultman, and Aaron wants to know, and you are better suited than me to answer this question. He says, what does the future look like for Ronnie Mauricio with Lindor on the team? Does he go into spring training playing shortstop? Do the Mets see him as the future at third base? Would they use the spring to see him there?
I mean, I think Mauricio is not a guy who's going to impact the 2021 big league roster, so you probably leave him at shortstop regardless. If You know, if you're thinking long term, Mauricio is a guy who might be up at some point in 2022, but probably not to start the year. Like, he's probably, you're thinking of someone who might come up at some point later next summer and then more of a regular player in 2023. So with that in mind, you know, if you extend Lindor in spring training, you can probably leave Mauricio at short for this season and then look at him more as a third baseman starting next year. I mean, he's a guy who's, I think he's 6'3". So he's pretty tall to play
he's
short
listed
to
at,
begin with.
Listed at 6'3", 166, I saw, which means like, who knows where it goes from there, right? Like, he's so young.
Yeah. And I think there's been some thought that he'd end up at third anyway. Like, if he sticks at short, it's probably as an average to below average defender at short. And the good news is that, you know, the bat should be able to play at third base. Like, he should be able to hit for enough average, enough power, enough production to be a corner infielder at third for you, you know, in a way that, like, you weren't sure about with Amed Rosario, at least not once he got to the majors. So I think that's probably the plan. I think, you know, a lot of fans think about these things more in advance than they need to. Like, covering the Red Sox, Mookie Betts came up as a second baseman, and it was, you know, once they signed Dustin Pedroia to an 8-year contract extension in 2013, it was like, well, they can trade Mookie Betts now and get the best they can get for Mookie Betts. And he clearly has had the athleticism to play the outfield and play it as, you know, arguably the best outfielder in baseball, especially in a corner outfield spot. And Betts could play center. You know, the only reason he didn't play center was the Red Sox had Jackie Bradley. That's where he moved initially. So, you know, I think Mauricio is a guy. There are other options for him to play. A fan might say, well, then you've got Vientos and Beatty at third. What do you do with them? These things work themselves out over time.
You know what we call those things? We call those good problems. If you have too many good players at a position, that's fine, right? Like, with Mauricio, I think you keep him at shortstop for as long as he can play shortstop. And if it turns out he's a big league shortstop and he's in AAA, then you've got a good problem. And you can, because shortstop is the hardest position on the field, you could presumably move him basically anywhere else except pitcher or catcher and have him succeed there. And if you feel that his value is all wrapped up in his being a great defensive shortstop, then you can perhaps look to trade him at the time and get back, you know, whatever you would get for a potentially elite prospect in a couple of years. So, yeah, I would say it's an interesting thought because, you know, obviously you want Lindor to be the long-term solution here, and they do happen to have a pretty promising shortstop prospect. I don't think it's like the type of thing that needs to be a front burner issue for the Mets anytime soon.
Yeah, I mean, like, catcher and first base are the only positions where this is legitimately a problem long term. And now with a designated hitter coming in, even those spots are not as big a problem as they once were.
That sounds all good. Thank you to Aaron for sending us a question. If you would like to ask us a question, you can email me at asktedberg@gmail.com. I promise I will relay the questions to Tim. You could get at either of us on Twitter. I am at OG Ted Berg. Tim is at Tim Britton. That's right, right? There's nothing else in there. And you can rate us and review us on iTunes or wherever you might rate and review podcasts, especially if you're polite. Tim, enjoy the next few days of workouts. We will hear about baseball players practicing.
Oh, it's everyone's favorite time of year. It's pitcher fielding practice time, Ted.
I love PFP. I miss it. It would be pretty good to be in Florida watching pitchers like laugh at each other as they botch bunts on the first day.
Adios.
Yeah, peace out.